Well, I'm Jan Bowman, and this session is called Listening to the Sacred in the Poetry of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And yesterday, several of us took a hike called Hiking to the Sacred Sounds of Hopkins Poetry. And so those in the group who did that, of course, have an edge on the rest of you. There are students, and then there are students, right? we're all, I want to make it out. Make it very clear that we're all equals in this session. Hopkins' poetry is a bit eccentric, and it has puzzled people ever since it was written, so almost anything goes in this session. I'd like to introduce him a bit by talking about his life. He was a very gifted child. He painted, he drew, he was musical, he composed, and his parents were also gifted in the arts. Both of them painted. He went off to Oxford College and at 19 years of age and got caught up in what was called the Tractarian movement or the Oxford movement, which was a kind of pull toward Rome or Roman Catholicism on the part of high church Anglicans. Hopkins was one of those young undergraduates who felt completely conflicted. He had a Greek professor who was liberal, who was using biblical historicism. I don't know if any of you remember your college years when your religion professor shocked you by saying these were all myths in the Bible and you were taught to demythologize the Bible. But Hopkins got caught up in that on the one hand. On the other hand, he was drawn toward a professor named Pusey who was high Anglican and practicing what we would call Roman Catholic rituals. Eventually, John Henry Newman approached him, as he had other undergraduates, and Hopkins converted to Roman Catholicism, which of course created a split in his family. It's a typical parent-child split. He not only converted, he went on to become a Jesuit priest, which is one of the most demanding of the Roman Catholic orders. And after spending several years as a novice, he then went on to study theology at St. Buenos in Wales, which is in a gorgeous part of Wales. I highly recommend a visit there. The brothers are very hospitable, and there are lots of hiking trails around there, and you can see as far as the sea between Wales and Ireland on a clear day. It's just a wonderful place. It's also that part of Wales that captivated Wordsworth, if you like Wordsworth's poetry, and Mount Snowdon is off there in the distance, which Wordsworth wrote about in his poem, The Prelude. At any rate, after St. Buenos Seminary, Hopkins, who was very, very bright, he got firsts in classics at Oxford, went off to be a pastor. And of course, you go where you're assigned. He had a hard tour of duty in Liverpool, which was becoming very industrialized, and he saw the poverty that followed in the wake of industrialization. He has written poems about blacksmiths, for example, and the blacksmith whom he cared for in Liverpool. Chesterfield was another site of his ministry, and he ended up in Dublin, Ireland, teaching the classics. His health was not good, either physical or, I guess you'd say, psychological. He worried too much. He was very conscientious. At any rate, as I said to the group yesterday, he almost literally died of over-conscientiousness in grading exams. He had 300 or 400 exams to grade each term, and he took it too much to heart. I feel that way sometimes at the end of a semester, too. I mean, I can actually get into a state over whether I should give a student an A- or a B+. It seems to matter so much today. But I want to emphasize not his anxious ways, but rather the fact that from the time he was a very small child, he was captivated by beauty. And a Jesuit scholar who teaches at Boston College has written in this little article, "The beauty of the world seduced him utterly." I like that. Seduced him utterly. He saw, heard, touched, smelled, and tasted this beauty with such clarity and intensity that the world seemed newly minted, freshly made, a paradise of wonder and magic. every morning for him was the first day of creation. And I think we feel that keenly at Holden. You know, every morning you wake up, you're awestruck again by the beauty. But of course, imagine feeling that way if you're growing up very close to London. Of course, he did have some fields in which to roam, but I mean, he was so caught up in this beauty. Now, of course, many scholars try to say that he then had this tremendous tension between his seduction toward beauty and the arts and his religious discipline. I wrote a master's thesis on Hopkins, and I disputed that notion. I tried to show how the two went together, and how, in fact, in adoring beauty or being seduced by it, he fulfilled or completed his praise of God, so that he saw, not exactly as the pantheist would, but he saw God in all things of nature. He said, for example, in his journal, I am thrilled by the beauty of these bluebells. I know the beauty of the Lord by them. You know, and other places he said, all things give off news of God. So beauty for Hopkins was the central, I would say, theology, as well as compelling philosophical notion that motivated his life. And even though he burned his poems before he went into the Jesuit order, which, you know, I see as a sort of momentary caving in to what he thought were the requirements of that discipline, I don't really see this tremendous split that other scholars see. So what I'd like to do chiefly today is talk about the poems and to give you a chance. We're a small group, so I think we can do, I was going to divide us into groups, but I think we'll just do it as an entire group. And I promised the hikers yesterday that we would look at some of the same poems so that we'd have a chance to go over them again. And we'll do that, and then I'll add a couple. So the first one we're going to look at is called Spring. And this is one of the poems that he wrote in 1877 while he was at St. Buenos Seminary in northern Wales. He wrote his 10 of his best sonnets, I should say, during that year. Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds in wheels shoot long and lovely and lush. Thrush's eggs look little low heavens, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring the ear, it strikes like lightnings to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue. That blue is all in a rush with richness. The racing lambs, too, have fair their fling. What is all this juice and all this joy? A strain of the earth's sweet being in the beginning, in Eden garden, have get before it cloy, before it cloud, Christ Lord, and sour with sinning. Innocent mind and mayday in girl and boy, most, O maid's child, thy choice, and worthy the winning. Now, I don't intend today to talk too much about poetic form or diction, although if that's important to you, we can do that. But you recognize right away that this is a sonnet because it has a verse of 8 lines, and then the 6th line, the sestet, is divided into 2 parts. In a way, all sonnets set up either a question or a problem in the octave, and then the sestet answers that or responds to the question. So you see that pattern here operating, although the question really comes at the beginning of the sestet, which is interesting. Okay, now what I'd like to do is just invite you to make comments. The comments can be of 2 kinds: what you think you do understand and you'd like to pull out of the poem, or what is puzzling to you, what you'd like to ask questions about. And then we'll all contribute to this discussion and try to arrive at some idea of what the poem is about. So who has a comment to start with, or a question? What does the poem seem to be saying, especially in the first eight lines? All these objects in nature, weeds and lambs and thrushes, eggs. New birth. Okay, lots of new birth going on in the octave. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's action. Movement, action. Uh-huh, great.
Very, very sensual.
Yes.
Spring is most dramatic, I think, in the northern climates.
Mm-hmm.
After a long winter, you know, in March.
Exactly.
Yes. And bingo comes spring.
Yes.
The robins come when the grass shoots up.
Uh huh. And now that Carol has moved to Minnesota,
she knows it.
Right. But what you're remarking about in terms of the sensuousness or the sensual qualities of this poem, I think both are there. We're invited to participate in this with all of our senses, aren't we? That line about the thrush's song does so rinse and ring. It almost sounds painful, doesn't it? It strikes like lightnings. In other words, you're struck to the core with this phenomenon in nature. You feel it to the very innards of your being. What else do you notice in here?
Color.
Okay.
Visual,
mm-hmm.
as well as physical.
Right. Which color stands out for you?
Blue.
All right. Thrush's eggs look little low heavens, and then later we get the blue, right? Okay. Now, one thing that I wrote on the board was sacramental vision. And although little low heavens might sound like maybe it's a colloquial phrase, you know, they look like little low heavens, at the same time, it's almost literally true for Hopkins, because he sees in these things of nature their outward reflections of what is inwardly their essence. And that essence for him is divine. It speaks of the Creator. So you see, looks little low heavens. It's as if you've got heaven coming down to earth here in these eggs, and you can see them nested there, can't you? And they are probably blue or gray-blue as well, you see. So it's as if you've drawn the sky, the heavens, down to earth here, and Hopkins is saying, this is where I see God and his goodness. It's right here. All right, let's look at the next six lines, 3 and 3. What do you think the poet is saying here? What is all this juice and all this joy?
Reminder of the perfection of creation. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that he's reminding us each spring is like a new beginning, just like Eden.
Exactly. Yes. Now that's a sort of, I suppose, statement of renewability that some of us don't always feel. We feel that the world is fast going down into its, degenerating, right? That it's running out of this Eden stuff, this juice and joy. The poet is strongly asserting here that it's there, but he gives a sort of cautionary statement at the end, doesn't he? Have get before it cloy. What do you think he's saying there? Before it cloud.
It can move you. Take the now, it's here. Mm-hmm. Don't delay.
Mm-hmm.
You aren't going to live forever.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's almost a carpe diem notion. Yes, all things are mortal, aren't they, as well?
Mm-hmm. I guess I have to look at the last two lines. I almost lose track of the syntax.
Right.
Have yet before it cloy, before it cloud, and sorrow sinning, and I assume that Christ Lord is a, you know,
noun of address?
Or an address, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's what's problematic.
Mm-hmm. And then, I'm not sure whether Innocent Mind and Mayday and Roman Boy goes back to this whole, the garden of, whether that was, whether that has a Eden, the Eden garden,
mm-hmm.
or whether that's the address. mean, it's just, I've moved the last two lines, I don't understand what's in that.
It always causes problems, you aren't alone. Beverly?
Most is the word that I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, could it mean, innocent mind and May Day, that is this Eden strain in girl and boy, are most, O maid's child, thy choice. They are most thy choice and worthy. It's sort of like remember your creator in the days of your youth before the evil days come and you will say, I have no, what is it? I have
most
no.
Most thy choice is worthy of winning, but mm-hmm. they are the innocent mind of the maid and the child.
Right. But whether Christ Lord is being addressed here in a noun of a positive, you know, an appositive, a noun of address or not, that is very difficult. And it changes the meaning, whether you believe it does or not. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm wondering, O maid's child would be an apostrophe, wouldn't it?
Right.
And by placing that there, it confuses the line more. I wonder why he put it there. Is there an ambiguity or is it that does something with sound or rhythm? I'm not quite sure. Because that's, you know, that creates a stumble.
Mm-hmm. Well, as with most poets, Hopkins leaves out words. He's aiming for compactness, but he does more than that. He uses nouns as verbs. He uses verbs as nouns. He inverts the word order, you know. And so it's just like Emily Dickinson's poetry and its ellipses, for that matter. So one thing that I often ask my students to do is to write out a prose paraphrase of the poem and try to develop this into a whole sentence. Now, of course, that destroys the poetry, but it helps when you're getting at meaning. And rather than lingering, I hope you won't mind if we just leave the ambiguity there and go on to some other poems, because there are lots of different ways to work this out. But I think the essential idea is that there is this strain of Eden still in the world. Hopkins believes that, and that he notices it most in the spring. And it should inspire us in some ways. It should inspire us to recapture that strain of the earth's sweet being in the beginning, that we have that sweet being in us. I don't think he's only addressing young people here. You know, I think he's addressing all of us. So part of the vocabulary that we use to discuss Hopkins' poetry includes inscape and instress, which were words that he coined. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit more as we look at a poem called As Kingfishers Catch Fire, because it's untitled.
It's named for its first line here.
No, I don't know your name.
Cheryl. Glad to meet you, Cheryl.
Now, I'd be happy to have everyone here read a poem. So would anyone like to read this one? There's so many hands, I don't know who to choose. Beverly, will you read?
I've never read it
okay.
before. Then. As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame, as tumbled over rim and roundy wells, stones ring. Like each taut stream tells, each hung bell's bow swung finds time to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same, deals out that being indoors each one dwells. Cells go, goes itself. Myself, it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. I saw more, but just man, justice keeps grace, that keeps all his goings, graces. Acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in men's and lovely in eyes not his, but the Father through the future of men's faces.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The idea here centers around this notion of inscape, and maybe you can figure out what inscape is just by reading that that first stanza. That's exactly it. Inscape is precisely that, that everything in the created world has a distinctive pattern. And it's a unified complex of sense data. By that I mean we perceive it as through various means, because of course birds, we not only see them, but we hear their songs, right? We may, if we're lucky, we might even get one to perch on our shoulder or our hand, and we feel their little feet. This morning, I was lucky enough to be walking down the fire road behind the chalets as the doe with her twin fawns were grazing there. And of course, I would love to touch those fawns. That's not possible. But I was so close, I felt that I could. You know, and there is something about being so close to them that the texture of their fur, of their coat, seems almost, it almost seems as if you are feeling it. Do you know what I mean? It's like down. That's the way I imagine it. It's so soft and fluffy. Now I'm receiving that through my eyes, but you see, I'm combining it with my gift of touch at the same time. At any rate, all of these things go together to make us who we are, and inscape is that distinctiveness. Actually, one of my students defined it as innate godliness, which I like too, innate godliness, because Hopkins saw the divine in everything. So in capturing the essence of a thing, you also capture its created good or its godliness. So all of these things in nature do something that is unique, as Carol was saying. They do or they are something unique. And kingfishers, the beautiful blue and rose and ivory feathered bird, catches fire. Why? And why do dragonflies draw flame?
Light goes through their wing.
Yeah.
So as the wing goes out, it's the color exudes from it.
Exactly. So what the poet's saying, you see, is that things in nature radiate this inscape. That's one of the ways that we know it. It flashes from them. But there are also certain properties that they have that draw light, you see, before it is given out. So all things in nature are working together to produce this uniqueness. The sun has to be there, right, in order for the kingfisher to appear that way, or the dragonfly.
Maybe the kingfisher is when he dives, probably then visually.
Ah, yes.
That might be the way that the fire seems to be.
I think that's a very good idea, because of the rapidity of their dive, you know, that it blurs into
so
one.
Quick.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm certain that's what he had in mind. And then if you throw a stone into a round well, it will ring. It can do no other thing, right? It was created to do that. And then the next line, each tucked string tells, and you can imagine all the music we've had at Holden involving strings and plucking, for example, a cello string. What does that do? The note sounds itself. The note sounds G or A or whatever it's tuned to be. It's uniquely itself. The same thing with the bell up here by the dining hall. The tongue of that bell, right, is flinging out its name. Now, all of these things, of course, are like announcements. They're announcements from that inwardness, that nature, that created nature of being. They're flashing out or sounding forth. So, each mortal thing does one thing and the same, deals out that being. Indoors, each one dwells, selves. And here's an example of how Hopkins uses a noun, self, and turns it into a verb. Why should he want to do that? Selves, strange. I think self
the
is...
opposite of a reification. I mean, instead of making a thing out of something,
yes,
it's making an act out of a being.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we've seen all of these other things in nature in their activity, which Hopkins says defines them. The way they act is how they can be defined. And the same thing is true for us, right? Everything, every mortal thing does this, selves, goes itself. Myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. Okay, now we've got created purpose in here. And then, of course, yeah.
Did you underline that, or is that italicized
no,
in his...
No, it's italicized in his work, yeah. This is a cry, I think, of the spirit or the essence of each thing. And if we truly listen to the sacred, this is what we hear. We hear essences. We hear uniqueness. We don't say of our child, oh, I wish you would wear your hair like all the other boys, you know. Because hair might be the one way that that child is saying, this is me. Now, of course, we know that this can be carried to extremes sometimes. We aren't going to talk about that.
Did Hopkins go for that?
I don't have any idea about hair length, I think.
Do you think this could also be speaking about written at the time that he was having the civic conflict, whether he was going to be the spokes and cabal, you know,
mm-hmm,
all the people who were trying to influence his life,
mm-hmm,
saying, you know, here I am myself and who I am is what I'm going to be.
I think that's very possible. Although the poem was written much later, it could have referred back to that period. Well, then in the sestet, we have more evidence that we cannot really know something like justice until we see it enacted. Justice is an abstraction. So he's going to take this a step further. I say more. The just man justices. And there again, he takes a noun and turns it into a verb. And the remarkable thing is that that verb sounds like the just man justice is, defines justice, you know, have no other way of knowing it, keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces. We had this wonderful discussion of sinning boldly in Mark Edwards' class the other day, and I thought of these lines because I think that... somehow, it's a miracle, the relationship between faith and works. And somehow, if you keep grace, that will keep all of your goings graces. I can't say it any better. All of your actions full of grace, which, of course, means that you will act justly. I mean, it's so difficult for me to separate the two because now I think I come back to... back to faith through Hopkins at a certain point in my life. And he really helped me to understand that these are so intertwined that I shouldn't worry about it too much. And then the rest of the lines are marvelous, of course. We've heard this before. Luther tells us, in fact, that we are all little Christ. Here, Hopkins has Christ playing in 10,000 places. And I love the word plays there. And then notice, lovely in limbs. That's, you know, Christ is lovely in our lovely limbs. We make Christ lovely. And lovely in eyes, not his. The loveliness of our eyes is the light of Christ in them. To the Father through the features of men's faces. I think this is one of those statements about Christ's continuing presence in the world that is very dramatic, very profound. I don't know how to put it better than this. Do any of you have a comment about this or further interpretation of it? Well, let's move on then. Let's look at God's grandeur, which we read up by the up by at level 3. This is on your first sheet. And it was a perfect setting for reading that poem because we had all of the accumulated rejects, the appliances that have worn out, and all the wire. And, you know, even though the world is charged with the grandeur of God, it will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with soil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel, being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, and though the last lights off the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. When we were standing up there with our eyes on the mountains and on the trash heaps at the same time, we started to feel pretty bad about all the generations that have trod and trod and trod. And of course, Hopkins was a part of an industrial age that was terrifying to some and exhilarating to many. And we too, we don't quite know what to do with technology that's grown out of industrial age. But again, the first two lines, what do they seem to be saying? Or the first three or four lines? This grandeur of God. What is its chief characteristic?
It's very like the other.
Yes, it is. It's something that...
Charged.
It's charged, yeah. It's almost like an electric charge. We won't spend too much time talking about like the ooze of oil crushed because that's been the subject of too many critical essays. I don't think we want to
that
spend
them.
Yes, yes.
Do you think Milton influenced the last
Lines of the poem?
Dove-like sets brooding, you know, the beginning of the poem.
Well, I have no doubt that Milton was one of the influences, because I know Hopkins read Milton and really liked him. Mm-hmm. And what is the notion there of the last lines? The Holy Ghost brooding over the bent world.
Warming it,
mm-hmm.
Helping it to hatch.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Somebody has complained about these lines. It sounds like some mad wet hand. I don't think I agree. I think it's a lovely image. Yeah.
Feminists start out doing because we don't like God the Father, so we'll take God the Mother. But, mm-hmm. you know, then you start getting into all these genderized things that don't necessarily make everybody, don't really work for quite everyone. So looking for alternate images, and that's what I was thinking of the connection between some of the concerns for our created order now, you know, having images of God that are not so, that are not genderized one way or the other,
yes.
But there are some other kinds of images, and this is clearly one of those kinds of images.
I think it is too, because it's powerful and it's nurturing at the same time, it seems. What were you going to say about it, Linda?
Is it the quality? Mm-hmm. But it is, it has that, mm-hmm. it has the qualities you want. To,
you raise a question for me about the work think the word that jumped out for me, because I think it's a very feminine, it's like a male here, feminine structure, and yet I just thought, you know, men have breasts also.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and you know, is that a joint venture? It is.
Oh, I think it is, yeah.
But I would immediately transfer that as a...
I know, you're supposed feminine. To say chest if it's a man, right? But men do have
breasts. We don't eat.
Exactly.
And nurture.
Yeah. Jesus has a bosom.
And recent ways, which is very positive to see fathers as nurturers again. I mean, we're imaging that as an okay thing.
Yes.
I was really pleased on Father's Day that Time magazine, there was a Newsweek out there. Time had a wonderful article on about fathers as nurturers. I mean, it's finally happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the public union. That's good.
I like the image of the bent world because you can see that as horizon, you know, the way the horizon bends. But what other kinds of connotations are there, do you think?
You've got all these generations prodding.
Right.
Back from old
life. That's right.
Burdened,
yeah, definitely. Or even bent with sin, you know.
Deformed,
yeah. Misshapen, yeah.
But I like the ending, too. You know, it starts with the world is charged with the grandeur of God. And then at the end, it tells how the Holy Spirit is indeed brooding, but it also has that holy quality of bright wings or that special lifting up, or I don't know what you'd say, but that isn't the ordinary. So it again brings us back to the grandeur of God and the charge that is capable only by a creator.
Oh, that's excellent. Yes.
Stands out.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we could spend more time on that, but we have some more poems. I think we'll move on here. I'd just like to read from his journal here before we do that. However, there's one use of his term inscape here that I think is it helps us to look at. I thought how sadly beauty of inscape was unknown and buried away from simple people, and yet how near at hand it was if they had eyes to see it and it could be called out everywhere again. So it reminds me very much of that passage in the Bible where I think it's Jesus who says, "Let him who has ears to hear hear it," you know, so eyes to see, you have to have eyes to see and ears to hear. So what Hopkins is doing is really very similar to what the romantic poets, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Sheets. Shelley and Keats are doing. And that is to try to lift the film of familiarity from our eyes and help us to see the world anew. Another way of speaking about that is innocence of eye, which was John Ruskin's term. And again, I think this is the perfect place to be in, to get that innocence of eye again, to lift the film of familiarity so that nothing in creation appears to us as mundane, but rather as especially unique and fresh and wonderful again. This applies to human beings as well as the things of nature, and I have to keep reminding us of that because I think that we tend to look for this freshness in things of nature other than human beings. Yes, we look at children and we say, aren't they fresh and wonderful? You know, but somehow the adult person becomes tarnished and familiar very quickly, and I think that's sad. I think we have to keep looking for inscape in our fellows, in our friends. Our
once
fellows.
Once read that Madeline LaEngle said, who's written both for adults and children, but says, whenever I get discouraged with the world, I go back to writing for children because they have not closed the shutters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of that, too, as the film, you know, familiarity, that children, the shutters are still open, ready to accept, whereas sometimes we adults.
Yes, I think that's very true, but this poetry gives me, it makes me so excited because I think that it's possible for us to renew ourselves in that respect every day. All right, now Let's see. Well, I think I'm just going to read for you a poem called Hurrahing in Harvest, which I wanted to read on the trail yesterday, but we didn't get that right moment where the sun was on bonanza, you know. And I want to read this to prepare for a definition of in stress.